Hi, I'm Abby Ellsworth. I'm a civilian interviewing law enforcement from around the country. My goal is to tell the real stories of law enforcement, the ones that don't make the news. Today, I'm joined by Scott Medlin. Scott found his calling as a police officer, a career he knew he wanted since high school. After his deployment with the United States Marine Corps in 2003 and 2005 for Operation Iraqi Freedom, Scott fulfilled his dream and joined a police department in North Carolina. His most thrilling role was as canine handler. He loved tracking, and as he says, the adrenaline rush of running in, not knowing what you're going to come up on. But his commitment to the job was overtaking his life and taking its toll on him and his family. He decided to leave the streets to become a school resource officer, another role Scott came to love. Ultimately, after 15 years in law enforcement, Scott chose to leave the profession in 2020. When his PTSD, addiction, and depression became too much. It was also at this time he learned that more officers were dying by suicide than in the line of duty, a stark reality that made him realize he had not been alone in his struggles, and one that motivated him to devote himself to helping other officers. Since then, Scott has become a national speaker, author, and content creator. He speaks openly about his own experiences, lessons he learned, and how he has turned those into actionable steps and advice on how you can stay healthy mentally and physically. He has presented at numerous first responder conferences and police academies, and he has just published his fifth book, The Power in Showing Up. In fact, many of you listening may know of Scott's work. In fact, many of you listening may know Scott. Scott, let me welcome you. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, I'm honored to be here. I appreciate it.
We connected. I guess you sent me a message, very clever video message. And I actually had known of you because you did interviews a while back with my buddy Anthony McNeil on his podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had fun being interviewed by Anthony. Twice, yeah.
Twice, exactly. So I've known of you, of your work, have followed you, very much admire what you do.
Thank you.
I think you're really helping lots of folks out there.
I sure hope so. And you're proof that I never know who's listening.
Exactly. Same here. I never know who's listening. We have a lot to talk about in terms of the work you're doing, which I think is really important. I'd like to get to know Scott, the police officer. You have quite a compelling story. You know, a lot of my audience did serve in the military. Were you inspired by 9/11 to join the military? Because it's right around that time, right?
Actually, I went to boot camp at Parris Island, South Carolina for the United States Marine Corps, June, July, and August of 2001. We graduated August 31st, 2001, and I reported back in for my very first day of Marine Corps training on September 11th, 2001.
No, you didn't.
I got off the bus at Camp Lejeune for combat training, which every Marine goes through. The Marine that welcomed us, well, I say welcomed, anyway, and right as we got off the bus, the first plane had already hit. And just like a lot of people, my mind went towards it was an accidental crash. And then we just watched it unfold from the bus station and all throughout the day. And let's just say combat training took a whole new meaning on that day.
Wow. That's insane. Mm-hmm. That is insane. What was going through your mind?
A lot of what we were talking about during combat training was people would, I don't know where the rumors would start, but I mean, we were going to war with this country. We were now going to, I'm like, how are y'all hearing this? It just happened. But it was just, everyone was trying to figure out what's the next step. When are we getting deployed? What war are we going to fight? Nobody knew, but we were all just in it like, well, maybe this happens. Maybe that happens. I mean, we just knew there was going to be a fight brought to someone somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Did it make you say, I want to go home now?
Well, originally, I'd entered the Marines to be in the reserves so that I could go to college and then go through the officer candidate program through the Marines to become a commissioned officer after college. I knew right then and there on September 11, 2001, my plans were probably going to be altered big time. And I remember calling my dad and saying, Dad, I'm not going straight through college. I'm going to go to war somewhere at some point. And mm-hmm. I did. I'm not saying that Iraq and 9/11 were related. I have a whole mixed bag of emotions when it comes to that conflict. But I remember that day when I told my dad, I'm not going straight through college. I just knew.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You know, we have a whole law enforcement career to talk about. But was it, did the trauma PTSD start on your deployments? How bad were they?
Yeah, that's a good question. It actually did. My second deployment in particular, I was in the back seat of a Humvee on a convoy, three other Marines in the vehicle with me, and we went through a close mortar fire attack. The first one exploded so close to the Humvee that literally it moved my right leg into my left leg, and I felt kind of a shift in my body towards the center. I mean, I had my seatbelt on, so I didn't move to the center, but there was a concussion there, the concussion from the blast. And that happened, and then the mortars kept coming down close to us. I remember looking out and seeing the dust and the sand fly out from one of the explosions, and I thought to myself, dear God, please get me out of this alive. And it was incredible. Just this moment of peace and not feeling alone came over me. And right as that feeling happened, a Huey helicopter, which we weren't even scheduled for air support that day, started flying towards us, and then it went over us towards the village where we were pretty sure that the mortar fire was coming from. And the firing stopped. I think they got wise and realized they were not about to be alive much longer if they kept this up. But that incident, along with a few other incidents, but that one in particular played over and over again in my mind, even when I got home. Little did I know that with it replaying in my mind, that it was stirring up symptoms of post-traumatic stress. And for a year, basically the relationships within my family started to deteriorate. And a year after getting home, that's when the real battle started, in a way, because here I was physically home from war, but not mentally home from war. And my dad said, I'm losing you. I can't lose my family. I know someone who can help you. Let's go get some help. And I did. And I'm very grateful that I did. But that was my first exposure to PTSD, to which I still have to manage to this day, but I'm on the boat of, it's not a disorder. It's not a life sentence. You can manage it. You can treat it. In some cases it's cured, but just attack it head on and you can still live a life. Yes.
Yeah. When he said he was losing you, what did he mean?
Just the relationships were faltering and I was getting very irritable and angry. And of course I was very, you know, in my opinion, I wasn't the problem. Everybody else was the problem because they didn't know what I had went through, that nobody could understand. This was the harmful perspective I had, when in return, I just didn't know that the fact that I was reliving this incident over and over and over again was generating negative thoughts, negative emotions, negative actions, negative results in life.
Right. And I think that's where you talk about neuroplasticity in your book.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, to anyone who thinks they're in such a bad place that they can't change, the brain literally has the ability to rewire itself unless you have an actual brain traumatic, like it can be affected by traumatic brain injuries. Right. But ultimately, for many people who don't have some kind of serious like brain injury, the brain can actually rewire itself in its thought process and its ability to have you view things differently, and therefore shifting your perspective, therefore shifting the way you see things, because there's that saying, you don't see things as they are, you see them as you are. I think Napoleon Hill said that, and that's true. And I learned about that through my Marine Corps time and police time.
So how did you go then from when you get home, what drew you then to go into law enforcement?
Oh, I knew I wanted to work in law enforcement prior to the Marines, actually. My sophomore year in high school, 15 years old, I went to a career fair in the gym, and none of the careers were interesting. None of them. I spoke to people and I was just like, yeah, whatever, whatever, whatever. And then I go up to this police officer in uniform. I'm just like, he starts talking about what he does. And I was like, now that's something I could do. But it was like God slapped me in the back of the head and said, you're doing this. But I had watched Cops some while growing up. And it intrigued me as to what the officers were doing, because I don't know why, but as a kid, I really didn't like the thought that someone could do criminal activity to me or my family and try to hurt us. And if I could be that person to stop someone from hurting others, then that brought about a good feeling of, well, if I can do something about it, let's do something about it. And that's what got the gears turning back in sophomore year of high school. Yeah.
And I think I must have heard this in Anthony's interview. You did hundreds of ride-alongs.
Oh, yes.
And that you saw a guy trying to break into, I don't know if it was your house or someone else's house. Is that?
No, as a kid, I saw a guy who didn't live in the neighborhood. We were a small neighborhood. Everyone pretty much knew each other, but he was going door to door, looking in windows, getting very up close to doors whenever he would knock on them. Like most people just back away from the door a little bit. No, not this guy. He stood right at the door and he just kept going house to house to house. He got closer to our house. And my mom said, let me call your dad. But she called my dad, and he was like, no, you need to call the police. So she called the police. And I just remember thinking as a little kid watching this guy get closer to the house, I want the police here to protect me.
Yeah. And then you became one.
Right.
That's great. Was it what you thought it would be?
It was. I think that the job itself was exactly what I thought it would be. Certain other things turned out opposite of how I thought they would. But when it came to the job itself, I did, like you mentioned, numerous ride-alongs. And that really helped prepare me to understand what it was really about. That really helped me to understand there's a lot of processes behind the 10 to 20 minutes of action, or even less than that, can be followed by hour and a half, 2 hour, 3 hour, 4 hour, however many hours of paperwork, quote, paperwork, mixed in with the time you have to spend in a courtroom, the time that you do get pulled in for community assignments where you're literally standing in one intersection watching cars for hours on end. I mean, stuff like that. I just knew about it. I wasn't blindsided by it because of the numerous ride-alongs that I had went on.
One guy just interviewed who's 7 years on said when he started, it was just go time, like his first night. And he's like, wait, don't you ease me into this?
Yeah, right. No, yeah, no, you don't. No, they're once you start and you can't predict what you're going to be a part of. Yeah. And they will. And I am of the opinion, and I did this when I was a training officer. I told my rookies, I told them, I said, all right, rookie, let's get into it. We're going to, that's the only way you're going to learn. The only thing I would do is take them out to a desolate area with another officer, and we would do some scenarios right quick, mainly traffic stops, so they could get familiar with the equipment in the car, so that whenever they did the actual traffic stops out on the street or responded to the calls with blue lights and sirens, they knew at least where the equipment was and were comfortable with that. So that was just one less stressor on their mind. But yeah, I mean, you get thrown right into it. That's the way you're going to learn.
Yeah. Did you have a number of any critical incidents? I mean, every officer does.
Oh yeah, no, definitely. There were plenty. I've worked in one of the busiest districts in the city. Okay. And particularly when I worked on canine, anytime someone could potentially get violent, yeah, they called me the canine officer. Yeah. And I didn't mind it. I knew that was part of it. But yes, ultimately working in a busy district and then my time on canine, I was called to the quote high risk calls. Mm. Yeah, there were plenty of stuff. I have stories for days.
Okay. And well, I've got a few days.
But the thing that I might be jumping ahead, but the thing that got me was I really was never told in advance just how much the job can take a toll on you if you don't actively take care of your mindset and yourself. Yeah. I thought I was good though. I did. I worked out all throughout the career. I didn't want to be out of shape. I trained martial arts. I went to church. I had friends outside of the profession. In my opinion, I was doing all I needed to do, and I just let it at that. But I didn't realize there were certain things festering inside of me. I didn't realize that I was being irritable and complaining a lot at certain points. I wasn't very self-aware. Mm. And that's the stuff that I wish would have been taught to me during my career. Things might have turned out differently.
Yeah. Well, let's definitely touch on that. I want to do cover canine. Sounds like a really exciting job. What made you choose canine?
During my internship, my senior year in high school with the police department, I was asked by the captain who was kind of overseeing that intern program. He said, hey, the canine unit is training downstairs in the basement. Do you want to come watch them? I said, yeah, sure. Why not? After watching them, I was hooked. One of the dogs jumped into my lap and I started watching what they were doing. And I said, I want to do this one day. I really did. And it's not because I like dogs. It's just because I like the work they were doing and the things that the dogs were utilized for. And then prior to canine, I would make sure that I was the backup officer as much as I could be for the canine officers whenever they had to run tracks trying to find people. I loved every single bit of it. It was great. And I accepted the challenge. And fortunately, in 5 years into the career, yeah, I got on the canine unit.
Right, which is pretty quick, right? Or 5 years, is that typical?
Well, at the time, it was pretty typical to start getting on specialized units around the 5 year mark or then after. But now we have so many new officers. I mean, this is my opinion. But when I left in full time in 2020 with the city, there were newer officers. I'm talking 2-3 years getting on specialized units just because we didn't have a lot of veteran officers. I mean, and at bigger departments now, a lot of people are leaving, particularly the ones who can and are more experienced. And yeah, so we have a lot of newer officers, heck, newer officers training newer officers.
Yeah. What was your canine's name?
Romac.
Romac.
Yeah, Romac. Yep. He was crazy from day one. And I have an upcoming book called The Power in Showing Up. And I mentioned just how crazy he was from the get-go. This dog was wide open, and it led to a frustrating but rewarding career as canine.
What kind of dog?
He was a Dutch Shepherd, but there were also people saying he was mixed with Belgian Tavurin. I never did a DNA test. We were never able to know, but he was a black and brown furry guy with a white circle around his rear. So anytime we would track in the woods at night and I didn't have my flashlight, I would just look for that white spot on his rear, knowing where he was.
And what made him crazy?
His personality. He was just that dog that was stubborn. Just very hyper dog. And I, unfortunately, they say dogs are like their handlers. Yeah. I can be hard headed and hyper as well. So we just sometimes didn't mesh because I couldn't calm down enough to correct him efficiently.
Oh, funny. So first of all, he was it sounds like you did both NARC and tracking. So he was a generalist and a NARC.
He was full patrol dog. Yeah, he could do article search, canines, or article search, tracking, narcotics detection. Let's see, what else? Aggression. Yeah, he was full patrol.
Okay. Because out here they have bomb, narc, and generalist.
Yes, there's. I haven't heard generalist term before. That's interesting. But a lot of dogs do have the one task that they're trained to do. He mm-hmm. was trained in 7 different areas.
The way it works, do you patrol with him and then you respond? Is it a call out or do you respond?
Sometimes it was a call out, but mostly it was I would show up and work on a regular patrol team and respond to any other call that any other patrol officer would. But if someone ran from a store and into the woods or someone ran from a traffic stop and they needed a dog to track someone down, I would, leave the district if need be or go back up that officer immediately to get the dog and utilize the dog to capture people. Or, one time there was a chase that had happened during the nighttime with the highway patrol up the interstate. And the highway patrol was guessing an area, not guessing, but they had a good idea of what area, about 50 to 100 yard area of where someone tossed a gun out of the car that they were chasing. 6 hours after it, they finally got a hold of me and they said, hey, can you meet us on the interstate? And sure enough, my dog located the gun that was tossed on the side of the on the embankment. It was crazy. It was 6 hours after the fact. So all different kinds of things the dog would be called for. But normally when I utilized them was during my regular patrol shift.
Okay. So what made it so exciting for you?
Tracking in particular was the most exciting part, particularly the last year and a half that I worked with Romac. He and I finally started to get in sync with each other about tracking and finding people who had run from a scene and were hiding, finding someone. And it wasn't always someone engaging in criminal activity. There was one time we had to track down a guy who was suicidal and he ran away from his house. And we obviously in good heart couldn't just say, well, hope he comes back. We found him. It was 5:30 in the morning. I was so tired. I actually fell asleep in the passenger seat because I was training someone. I dozed off on the way there. I was that tired. But needless to say, it was cold outside, and with running behind Romac, I woke up pretty quick. And half a mile from the house near the interstate, we found the guy passed out drunk, but he did have a hammer. He intended on hurting himself. So, it was stuff like that. The tracking was by far the best part, in my opinion, of the job with a working canine.
And what about it? Just the excitement of it?
Well, yeah, there is the adrenaline rush of running in, not knowing what you're going to come up on, but also just knowing that it's up to me now to catch this person, because basically anything that could have worked prior to is no longer going to work. I got a call one day from a friend of mine who was a detective. They were after a theft suspect who was even wanted by the Secret Service, and the Secret Service was in town to help catch this guy. They finally tracked him down to a house via whatever technology they used to get into his phone and pinging his phone and getting his location. I think he saw the unmarked cars pull up to the house and he split out the back. He left his phone in the house. They had no other way to find out where he was. The frustration on the detective's face, the frustration on the agent's face, I could see it. And I said, well, let's try the dog. And sure enough, we ended up finding the guy. It was just that kind of stuff where it's up to me and the dog now to do what we can to find this person, because everything else has been tried. And that was always thrilling to just be running through the woods and all of a sudden, boom, there the person is. Yeah. Now, don't get me wrong. It's dangerous because, yeah, they hear us coming or they can see me coming before I see them. I knew that risk was there, but it was always worth it. We had captures that even exceeded the odds. Even one time running down a creek, I couldn't believe it. And we found the guy there on the embankment sitting there, and he was wanted for a probation violation. He looked at me, said, "Hey man, what's up? What are you doing here?" I said, "Man, don't play dumb. Put your hands behind your back."
Jeez.
Oh, so anyway, it was that kind of stuff.
I've heard officers say that you might have, I don't remember, have a gun pointed at them or something, but as soon as they see the dog, they're like, I'll cooperate.
it's amazing to me how much sometimes people would argue with me, would argue with four of us standing right there. But the second the dog came out, it pretty much was a de-escalating technique. I mean, they would be heated. And I would just get the dog out and they went to cooperating. That was de-escalation right there. Yeah. One time we got to a church where it was posted with trespassing signs, and there were some teenagers, one of which we knew was pretty engaged in theft regularly. And it was late at night and he started running. I said, "Stop or I'll send the dog." And he stopped. I mean, paperwork and foot chase and all that averted. He just stopped, right? I mean, I could hear his shoes squeak like the screeching of a car.
Oh my God.
He stopped instantly. And there was another time where an event at a nightclub got out of hand and the party just poured out into the parking lot. And I can't remember if this incident in particular, there was a few times we would get the infamous shots fired and we would all get there to that venue as quick as we could. I can't remember it particularly on this night if we got shots fired or not, but we were there because unfortunately the crowd was getting rowdy. And I walked into the parking lot with my dog. There's just people everywhere. And I actually noticed a guy who was wanted for a felony probation violation. And I told him, "Hey, you got a warrant. You need to come with me." He said, "No, I'm not going anywhere." And his friends kind of surrounded him. And I just let Romac get in front of me, and they just dispersed. And I was able to pull the guy in and push him off to the captain who was behind me, and they arrested him. So, I mean, it's just stuff like that. The dog worked wonders.
Yeah. Do you, you know, sometimes, at least these days, they criticize the use of a canine for biting, or how do you react to that?
There's obviously those officers who have abused their authority and used the dog as, I mean, there was one case that they talked to us about in Legal Update where there were people trying to break into a building and they cooperated with the officers, but the officer said, "I'm going to send the dog anyway." And I, based on what the lawyer told us during that class, that handler's still in jail or prison for utilizing the dog just for, I mean, punishment in a way, unjust. It is one of those things, just like anything in policing, if you abuse it, it's not right. Mm-hmm. So if an officer does wrong with the dog, then yes, there needs to be accountability, obviously.
Okay. And the other thing is that most people in law enforcement would know, but not everyone would know that the dog lives with you. It's your dog.
Absolutely. Yep. I saw Romac more than I did any member of my family for 3.5 years. He and I were together so much.
Yeah. The thrill of this really sort of overtook you. The thrill of the job, the role.
Yeah. I let that job consume me. I let it become who I was, and I should have never let it get to that point. But a lot of police officers do that, whether they would like to admit it or not. I'm not saying all of them do, but it can be way too easy to do where you feel that sense of calling and all of a sudden your value and your identity become wrapped up in the job. And I did that. My wife and I had our firstborn son in 2015. And this was when Romac and I really started working well together and doing a lot of great things. And I was really having a lot of fun. I was on an awesome patrol team. I mean, we looked forward to going into work with each other. We were having fun during the shifts working together. And I just wasn't present mentally at home. And I didn't realize it was a problem until February of 2016, my wife basically was like, "I'm getting really tired of this." And she basically said, "You need to make a decision." And I thought, well, we'll work it out. So I started taking time off, bringing my son to on days off, like bringing him to where my wife worked. and doing my best. But unfortunately, I was too far gone into the job where damage was continuously done. I was not doing a good job of processing some of the stuff I had seen on the job. And in around the summer of 2016, my wife was basically like, I'm going to do this on my own. I'm just going to do this on my own. And that was the wake-up call. And at that point, a few months later, I made the hard decision to resign from K9. It broke my heart, but it was the right thing to do to save my family.
Yeah. What kind of things had you seen that you weren't processing?
I mean, I had seen a young man who had been shot in the stomach. It was his last few breaths before he died. I didn't see him die. I found out he had passed away. So I knew that when I saw him, it was the last few breaths. There were successful suicide scenes. Those always bothered me. There were fights I had been in with combative suspects. And I just didn't cope with it well. I didn't take the time to go see someone at a bare minimum, talk it out. Instead, I just let the images, the events just run in my head over and over again. And it came out in the form of complaining. It came out in the form of not being present at home, as in I would just doom scroll on my phone. If my wife wanted to spend time with me, I would sign up for off-duty hours, getting more money, just because I loved being a police officer. So it was a lot of different things.
Yeah. It must have been just incredibly hard to give up.
It was. I was a grown man sobbing in my kitchen, holding Romac, knowing that I was giving him up. I felt like a complete failure at work. Obviously, some of the guys gave me a hard time. They said, your wife, she knew what she was getting into. You knew what you were getting into. Why do you have to be the one to give up your job? But I mean, one of them was going through a divorce, and he told me, well, divorce is not that hard. I was like, man, that's not even an option. Don't even go there. I couldn't believe it when he said that. It was very hard to watch Romac go work with someone else. But then in 2017, the first summer after giving up Romac, I got the call of a lifetime. My former patrol supervisor had called me. He said, guess what? The handler that Romac's with is leaving, and they don't want to give Romac to a third handler. Do you want to take him as your pet?
Oh, my God.
And I was ecstatic. I said, thank you, God. I'm getting my boy back.
Oh.
And as much as he gave me a hard time, and he was such a jerk at times, I was like, I'm getting him back, because he was so loyal. Like, he never hesitated to get between me and whoever was causing danger. He never hesitated. He was so loyal. And we got him back home. I was excited. My 2.5-year-old son is going, Romac, 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 you know. But he wanted to work, and he would see me leave in my police uniform, and my wife was working remote at that time. He would bother her all day because he was a working dog. He couldn't just hang out at the house, and he knew I was gone. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how smart they are.
Yeah.
Long story short, a few months later, he ended up attacking our pet dog over a piece of meat in the sink while my wife was gone and I was 3 hours away for training. She said, I can't do this. I can't manage him, because she was also pregnant with our second child. And we were nervous that if he was aggressive with the pet like that, he would be aggressive with the kids. And there was nothing we could do so far as putting a kennel outside. So I had to say goodbye to him again. And it broke my, I said, are you kidding me? But gave him back to the previous handler, and he ended up having to leave that home because of being aggressive and hurting someone. And he ended up living in Texas the last few years of his life at a ranch that took retired military or police dogs.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. I didn't really think about it. I did an interview a few episodes ago with a canine handler who talked about how well his dog handled retirement. And it was, the dog was probably older, but it hadn't occurred to me that it's hard for the dog too.
It can be. I mean, they're bred to work. And if they're just sitting around, and I mean, he would see me put on my uniform and he would get all excited. And out the door I go, because I was a school resource officer at that time. I couldn't bring him to work. He was no longer working as a police dog. So.
He could have been the school pet.
Oh, no, no. just for viewing.
Yeah. So then tell me about school resource officer. It's a role that I'm really passionate about. And, you know, there's been a lot of criticism of that role. And out here in the Seattle area, I think they've eliminated it for now anyway.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. It was a job that I surprisingly liked a lot. I was very shocked. Whenever I had to resign from K-9, I was going to quit policing in general. I just thought there was nowhere to go, so I just turned in my 2 weeks' notice. But the chief brought me in the next day. He said, we can work it out so that you can be put in the schools. You'll have more of a family-friendly schedule. Would you be up to that? And I said, yeah. They ended up putting me in a very busy middle school about 2 to 3 months after I resigned from K-9. And wow, I had no idea just how much that SRO at that school, she had been there 4 or 5 years, how busy she was.
Yeah.
And she was needed. And I got there and shadowed her for about 3 or 4 days. And then that was it. Yeah, I was just thrown into the fire in a way.
Yeah.
But I was just amazed very quickly at how much when I pulled the students into my office one-on-one and said, look, I know you're having a bad day. I can see it. Do you need to punch a pillow? Do you need to talk to me? Do we need to walk around the school? Whatever the case is, they started to see me as a person. And a lot of them started to turn towards me if they were getting upset. I know some of them said, Officer Medlin's my way out of class, but I told them that. I said, I'm catching on to you. You just want to get out of class to talk to me. But I was just amazed throughout my time as an SRO how much students can be impacted by the police on being on the campus and seeing police officers differently. And there was one student in particular, he changed my life. He, unfortunately, a family member of his died in police custody.
Mm.
Needless to say, regardless of the situation, regardless of the details, regardless of the outcome, in that incident, he looked at me and just obviously the pain came from that incident of losing a family member. I didn't hold it against him one bit the way he looked at me. I felt bad for him because I knew he was coming from a place of pain and he didn't know me as a person. He just saw the uniform and associated that my uniform with what happened to a family member. I was very empathetic with him and very patient with him. And unfortunately, our first encounter did not go down well at all. But I was still, after that, I was very patient with him. And one of the teachers who I worked with and got to know pretty well actually knew the student pretty well and told him, you know, Officer Medlin was just doing his job. He likes you as a kid. He does. And I attended a basketball game or participated in a basketball game with a mentorship program that this kid was a part of. Now he's a young man, but kid at the time. And I was out of uniform playing basketball and I got paired up against him. He schooled me. It was hilarious. I mean, he ran all around me. I mean, I'm not good at basketball, but at the end of the game, we shook hands and he smiled at me. We made eye contact and we were pretty much good for the rest of the time I was at that school. I will never forget him. He made such an impact on me. I hope I made an impact on him, but it just goes to show the power of an SRO being on school grounds, not only to protect the campus, but make a difference for the students who are hurting or who don't know who's going to be in their house that day or are going through unstable living conditions. It was heartbreaking to see, but at least I could be that person to talk to them or provide them with a cold water bottle or something, just little simple acts of kindness to distract them from what they were going through and the adversity of their personal lives.
Yeah. What was your first encounter with him? You said it didn't go well.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there was information about a weapon being on campus and with a group of kids and he was part of it. And it didn't go well. But fortunately we worked our way through it. And I miss him to this day. I do. There are so many of those kids. They had my heart, like as if they were my own kids. And, yeah. You know, what's amazing is a few weeks ago, I got a call from one of them, a former student of mine. He found me through my website and he reached out and he said, I want to be a cop. And now he's working for a sheriff's office as a corrections officer. And eventually he'll work his way to being sworn and on patrol. But how cool is that?
I was going to ask, you know, do you think your being there led any of them to choose law enforcement as a career?
This one in particular, I think it did because he in the middle school where he was, he was bothered by a lot of people. And I said, all right, man, come on, let's walk around the building. I don't want you to get into a fight. And we would just do laps around the school, anything to help prevent a fight. I hated the fights. And so, yeah, but obviously people change, people can change their perspective, people can learn from their ways when they're middle schoolers and high schoolers. Come on, we've all been there. and yeah, he's now working at the sheriff's office. It's really, really cool.
That's great. Well, and the young man you talked about, you know, this is the argument these anti-cop people give, is that the uniform, the gun, all of that is triggering to them. And so here's an example of a kid whose family member had a bad experience with law enforcement. So then he projects that onto you. But instead of doing what you ultimately did, which was create a relationship with him, have him see you as a person, you fixed that trauma for him. And so what they say now is, don't put police in the schools, as if that's going to help, you know?
I couldn't disagree with that anymore if I wanted to or tried to. I can't. That is, it's beyond me, because, well, one, we have the threat of active attackers coming onto a school campus, since it is an opportunity. They look for an easy opportunity and they want to kill as many people as they can. It is what it is. They want to kill as many people as they can. We need SROs on these schools because we don't know which school is going to be next. And yes, I know there have been SROs to completely fail in their response, but there have also been SROs to completely step up and protect their kids. There's guns on campuses. I mean, there's stuff on campuses. We need police officers. Now, obviously, just like any facet of policing, if an officer abuses their authority or conducts illegal searches, or I've even known SROs to get in relationships with some of the female high school students. I mean, it's happened. But overall, from a big perspective, we need police in the schools big time. And I just, if they can prove to me that it helps keep the students safer through facts and evidence, then I might change my mind. But as of right now, I'm just hearing it as a talking point and an opinion.
Yeah. Well, and keeping them safe, but also what you've just talked about, being that ear, being that mentor, being that guide, being someone, you know, you talked about, you know, the stuff that's going on at home that you know, so I don't know what specifically you saw, kids coming to school abused, malnourished. I mean,
some of them were, one in particular, I remember he was just so hungry. And then there was one who he didn't even know who would be in his house. I mean, he had a family member who was a big time, just regular criminal, for lack of a better phrase. And yeah, it brought criminal activity into the house, and the kid didn't know who was going to be in his house. And there were many incidents like that. Extreme poverty, seeing kids under extreme poverty conditions, sharing beds with family members because they just didn't have enough room, or that was the only mattress the family had. It's all kinds of sad situations. But also, being an SRO, I got to know some of these students where if they either chose to act up in the neighborhood or they knew about something going on in the neighborhood, I could relay that information to patrol to help squash the problem or catch whoever did the bad act, whatever the case was. So it is like a team effort with the police as well. Yeah. There's so many reasons to have SROs in the schools.
Well, and you know, when I was in school, there were no active shooters. So what was that? You had to help conduct that training to respond?
I did. Yeah. Yeah. Every year. And I took it very seriously. I said, we cannot be in denial or complacent about this. Our school at any point could be targeted by an active attacker, and we have to be ready. Here's the steps we're going to put in place. Here's the mentality I want everyone to have, so we're all on the same page. And here's what I'll do my best to stop it and respond afterwards to whatever damage has been caused.
Yeah. It's just, even just doing those drills has to be traumatic for them.
Well, to some of the students, yes. To some, it was a joke. But I mean, I remember one time during a drill, I heard kids laughing in a classroom, and I opened up that door as fast as I could. I said, please understand, the way you act right now is how you might act if something is actually going down and you don't know it's going down and you're still laughing and then it's too late. I got some eyes opened on that one. They looked at me like, oh, shoot.
Yeah. And so this role allowed you to not be as stressed at work. I mean, it was kind of like a step.
It brought a whole new level of stress, not a whole new level, a different level of stress that I never thought I would experience in policing. Yes, I was not out there seeing the gruesome things that could happen on patrol that you could be exposed to on patrol. I wasn't going from call to call. I wasn't getting that wide variety of work. I was in one building with the same students for the most part each and every day, but Monday through Friday for 6 to 7 hours a day, and pretty much only dealing with students who were choosing to behave badly. Not saying they were bad people, but they were making those choices. And if it warranted my involvement, then I was involved in it. And it, if I wasn't careful, I could be jaded just as much with them as I was on patrol in certain situations. So yeah, I mean, you got to be careful, and it's stressful with that too. Wearing a police uniform 5 days a week, there's a lot of weight on that uniform. Yeah. That was a stress in and of itself too.
Yeah. Yeah. You talk about that in your book. people don't think about the duty belt and how heavy that is.
It's a chronic stressor. It is it is like a slow drip effect. You're not even aware of it. And then all of a sudden you could be, I mean, heck, 3, 4, 5, 15 years into the career, whatever it is. And all of a sudden you're like, man, it's back pain, or my posture's bad. Or what? Well, let's just say the uniform didn't help it. It might not be the cause, but it didn't help it for sure.
Right, right. You then went to be university police officer. You got out of this, you left the department.
Yep. Left the department in 2020, and then went to part-time work at a university. Okay. And it was a pretty small university, so it wasn't that really intense, but it was an opportunity. Once again, it was 2020. It was right after the George Floyd incident. A lot of people were upset. I was upset about certain things. I shared the frustration, and it was just one more opportunity, particularly with a younger population, to show I can be a person talking to you as a person. And I enjoyed conversations with the students on campus.
And, you know, there are so many shootings on school campuses. I mean, what goes through your head when you hear that on the news? Because that could have been happened.
Oh, yeah.
School.
I mean, I arrived at the schools, whether I was an SRO or as the campus police officer, I arrived with the mentality of anything could go down at any given moment. And I could not get complacent, could not. And any police officer listening to this will agree with me. I don't dare say the Q word, the quiet, it should be a quiet day. Never say that when you're working as a police officer.
I've heard that. Yes. You've ruined it. No. Well, let's get to what was going on then with you mentally, emotionally, through this process that led you to where you are now. But I think I did note that, and I don't know if this was from Anthony's interview, in 2011, you had a supervisor who recognized you were having a hard time and told you it took some time off.
He did. Yeah, I was working a lot, and I was interacting with the same people who were engaged in criminal activity over and over and over again. I was just getting a little jaded, and that level of cynicism where you just have a negative view of a lot of people in the population. Mm. And he sensed that. He said, you're getting a little short with people. He said, not in a totally disrespectful way, but I can tell you're just getting, he's like, take some time off. And you know, that was a good leader to do that, because that can happen to anybody. And it's up to us to hold each other accountable, but also look out for each other. If you notice someone's faltering, or if you notice, hey man, you've been struggling. Is there something bothering you? Even if it has nothing to do with what you encounter outside, it has everything to do with some toxicity and negativity you face within the four walls of the department, which does happen. Mm-hmm. It was really good of him to tell me, hey, take some time off. And I did, and it helped reset everything. But particularly what was going on through my mind later in the career, between 2016 and 2020, with the having to lose the canine position, and then I also missed my patrol team. Mm. I mean, I was in the schools by myself, and my friends that I worked with for years, that they were still out there, and I just was like, God, I just want to be with the team.
Yeah,
that couldn't happen. I was very lost. I really was. I did my best to show up for the kids. I did my best. But inside, I was struggling with who the heck am I and what the heck am I going to do? And in 2020, in January of 2020, that's when I learned for the first time that more officers were dying by suicide than actually in the line of duty. Why was I not trained on that? It infuriated me. I basically thought to myself, you mean all these mental health struggles I've had, I was not alone? Because I thought I was on certain things. I was like, am I the only one feeling this way about certain things? I wasn't, and the statistics prove it. It's very unfortunate. So I just said, you know what? I've got to step up. If I can talk about the struggles I went through, maybe it can help someone. And I just felt called to jump into this fight, as I'd like to call it. in bringing down the number of officer suicides, officers being sucked into substance abuse or having abusive relationships or whatever the case may be, even engaging in impulsive behaviors that like spending, that's not healthy. Anything to help bring awareness to how we can sharpen our minds, our bodies to thrive and not just survive, but also get out of bad situations when we find ourselves in them emotionally.
Well, and this goes back to what you said at the top that when I wanted to make sure to come back to. So I think what you said is you were experiencing things, but you didn't know what you were experiencing.
Right. I really dove into researching signs and symptoms of the common things like depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, suicidality, alcoholism. Those are kind of the common things that police can find themselves going through if they're not careful. And as I'm reading through these signs and symptoms, I'm just like, wow, this person went through that. I went through this, but we didn't know about it because we weren't aware of any threats that could happen internally. My gosh, we knew every threat in the book that could potentially, right, you know, show itself on the job. And we knew what indicators to look for in case it did, but we didn't know anything about what to look for inside, like our minds and our body. We didn't know.
And why do you think that is? It just wasn't part of the culture?
Part of the culture. I do believe there's a level of, well, if we talk about this and we're admitting we're weak or something like that, or if, I mean, heck, to this day, a lot of police officers, some of them are not going to say anything. They don't want their job in jeopardy, to which I understand that. But it's like, I would rather get it addressed so that your job's not in jeopardy because you acted out because you haven't learned a way to cope with these emotions. And then they show themselves adversely later down the road. I mean, it's called post-traumatic stress for a reason. It's after the fact.
Right. Right.
It just wasn't talked about. But after 2019, when over 200 officers died from suicide, to which I'm not going to say it was all job related. Absolutely not. But the fact is at least 200 died by suicide. That was the big wake up call across the country, in my opinion.
Why are there so many officer suicides? Why are officer suicides on the increase?
From what I've learned in my research, relationships, feeling isolated, not feeling supported, the pain of going through seeing something traumatic, but then not feeling supported while dealing with that, and not knowing other ways out of the pain other than suicide. Through all the people I've interviewed who at one point were suicidal, that was the one thing they told me, that all in common were they didn't want to die. They just wanted to escape the pain, and they knew that was the way out of the pain. But obviously it's never a solution. It should never be considered a solution. And it does cause a lot of pain to those who are left behind, who actually do care about the person. So they should never convince themselves that someone would be better without them and people would be better without them. This world would be better without them. They should never convince themselves of that, particularly the law enforcement officers. And they're not alone. There's other ways out of the pain. That's what I have found. I really encourage anyone who really wants to dive deep into the factual evidence of suicides among law enforcement is look at Dr. Olivia Johnson's work with the Blue Wall Institute.
Okay. I just interviewed someone, he's now retired, who he would say, my family would be better without me. Maybe I'll just, you know, step backwards into traffic. You know, he felt like a complete burden to his family. There are a number of officers I hear say that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an officer who wrote his story in my book, 101 Health Tips for Police. He was thinking about killing himself because he was convinced his family would be better off without him in the picture.
And then I'm also finding how officers who retire are really struggling because a lot of...
Big time.
Yeah.
Big time. There's that identity piece. And if you lose that identity piece and your whole value and self-worth was wrapped up in the job and now it's gone, it can rip you right apart. I mean, I went through that when I resigned from K-9.
Right.
And I absolutely rip you apart.
Yeah. And so you decided to do something about it. One of the first things you did was to write a book.
Exactly. I'm trying to remember when, I think it was right after I learned that harsh statistic about the suicide, I said, what can I do to help bring these numbers down? And it's just the thought of write a book. It just happened. It was a thought. I thought that was for other people to do. Yeah. But I said, you know what? Let's go with it. So I wrote a book. And then in the fall of 2020, created a YouTube channel, to which I knew mental health and policing and wellness and inspiration and courage, I knew it wasn't going to go viral by any means. but I did it and I'm still doing it to this day, to which we also talk about current events and other things right. regarding policing. But right. Yeah, I did the YouTube channel. And within the last year, I really had a lot of opportunities to travel the country and speak to police officers, literally east to west. And been very honored to do that and appear on numerous podcasts to us. And thank you for this one now.
Sure.
But there's no going back. There's a lot of officers who are struggling. We may not know it. A lot of them might not admit it, but I also am here to squash the survival mentality that I hear all too often of same crap, different day. I'm just going to get through this and I'll be happy when I retire. That is not a way to live. That is existing. And I know that that really is not well received by certain people, but it's something we have to embrace, that we can't get into a survival mode through a career. We have to start thriving. And there's certain ways to do that through our mindset and the way we perceive things and the actions we take before and after going to work.
When you are meeting with officers, giving these conferences, are you sensing, are they being open with you? Are they?
Some of them are. Yes. Yeah. I'm amazed at how many come up to me afterwards and say, one, they knew someone or knew of someone who knew someone, an officer who died by suicide.
Mm.
I've had some come up to me and say, hey, thank you so much. That was very encouraging. That's exactly what I needed to hear. I've been struggling with this, this, that, and that. And I thank you for what you talk about. I've had some come up to me and say, this was needed. This was inspiring. I've had some come up to me and say, I can't do this anymore, but I don't know what else I can do. And I've had some former officers come up to me and say, I'm having such a hard time leaving the profession. And I was part of this traumatic incident and I'm still having a hard time coping with that. So I've had many come up and talk to me, but then yes, there are those who, when I do throw out some challenging perspectives, yeah, I can see the discomfort in their eyes. Like, how dare you even say that? But I don't say it like an adversarial way. It's just, we have to step out of our comfort zone to keep growing as people. Innately, our brain wants to conserve energy. So we'll do the same thing over and over again, even if it's unhealthy for us, just because we're familiar with it and there's certainty in it. What I have found is the more that you jump into the line of uncertainty and challenging yourself, yeah, it can be tough. But how many times have you grown stronger as a person because of something easy? Yeah. It doesn't happen. We need to go through tough times and you need to challenge yourself to stay in shape mentally, physically. And this is an active process. And the analogy has been thrown around time and time again. Police officers will show up so much and give it 100% effort for other people except themselves. And that's not everybody, but it can happen. Yeah. And that's what I've been receiving across the country, information about that from officers coming up and talking to me and from what I've observed.
What do you say that they disagree with or they find challenging?
Oh, there's a part where I talk about language, how our language matters. And I'm not talking about whether or not you're cussing on the job. I obviously have my opinion about that. But if you're saying phrases like, I'll be happy when, particularly I'll be happy when I retire, and you still have like 10 years to go, or officers say, I've got 15 down, 15 to go. That's how people in prison talk.
Mm.
You can't talk like that. You're focusing on something you don't have. Therefore, you'll miss out on the blessings that you do have. And I'm saying all these things for the most part because I learned them the hard way. If you're saying, when someone asks you how you're doing, you're saying, well, I'll be better in 12 hours when I'm back at home. That's not a good thing. Why would you go to a job that you can't stand? Either shift your perspective, start liking it again, or move on to something else, knowing that you have the ability to do something else, particularly through the numerous skills and experiences you've had in law enforcement. Some people are just focused in so much on the gossip of a department that it's just so negative. You can't get wrapped up in that stuff. So when I start talking about language and complaining and negative talk and survival comments, oh yeah, it will push some of them. They're like, oh shoot. Or they're like, oh man, forget you. I'm good. You know, it's just, it's a mixed reaction.
Yeah.
But like I said, we're not going to change doing with what's familiar. We're going to have to push ourselves beyond our comfort zone and normalize things such as getting professional assistance, staying in shape mentally and physically, which is an ongoing process, not using alcohol to cope, not just giving into impulsivity and expending risky behavior. If someone is not doing so well after seeing something on the job or experiencing the negativity on the job and they feel really bothered by adverse conditions within a department, because it can happen, if they're bothered by it and it's legitimate, then yeah, they can't be faulted for that. We're only people. We're not these invincible robots walking around without any emotions, without any feelings. It happens. We're people. But we also need to learn from our mistakes and support each other, even when we're not working, because as you can tell, it's a pretty challenging time to be in law enforcement right now. And the statistics show that suicide is still an active threat. Therefore, we have to be active for ourselves and each other. I could go on. So sorry about that long-winded answer.
You know, I also don't know why, and maybe you said this, you learn all these things in the academy, like how to fire your weapon, how to drive your car, but you don't learn how to take care of yourself mentally and emotionally.
There's a momentum throughout the country now from what I've seen where they are teaching that kind of stuff now. However, if it's not a quality instructor and the instructor's just reading a PowerPoint, it's pointless. It's pointless. Now, I do know some officers who have gone through an academy, and I asked them, how was the academy when it came to mental health, resiliency, taking care of yourself? And they were like, oh, yeah, there was something about that, but we went on to something else. It's like, no. Or it was just people coming in and sharing their war stories and what not to do. I guess that's a little bit better, but we really need to get on the same page so far as like a thriving mindset, knowing the resources out there that can help you if you're not in a good place, to which if you get in a bad place, it happens. Here's what you can do to work your way out of it through this professional assistance. But there is also good quality training, particularly in California. I know some that teach to the rookie schools and they are dynamic. So that's a great thing.
Okay. I know you have written 4 books. I'm reading your first one, which I personally find helpful. I'm not a cop, but the neuroplasticity in your brain. And so if you're an officer, like the first place to start is with the first book.
Yeah. Mental Health, Fight of the Heroes in Blue. I started that book because one, I was like, we just got to get word out about just how serious of a threat post-traumatic stress, anxiety, depression, suicide can be. So the first part of that book is breaking down the fact you're human. Like, you're going to be affected by things in your life, whether it's on the job or not. You are human and there's no escaping it. So please stop with the I am fine, I am fine. Trust me, I tried it. It doesn't work. And then I go into the reticular activating system of our brain. It's basically our brain's filter and how we see the world. So if you want to focus on negative, by gosh, your brain is going to filter every piece of sensory information it can on negative things. But if you say, no, I got to focus on things that'll make me stronger, opportunities out there, then by gosh, your brain's going to go to work on taking in information to help you focus on those. I break all that down and I say, we're human, accept it. The next thing is signs and symptoms that we need to be aware of that I was not aware of. And therefore it led to me having a career that I didn't want to leave it, but damage was done. And it is what it is. I had to leave for family's sake. And then I go into action items that you can take, because nothing changes for anyone unless you take action. And when you do take action to improve your mindset, things on the outside more than likely will not change, particularly at a department. But when you have a stronger mind, you start to perceive things differently. That's healthier for you. So that's what Mental Health Fight of the Heroes in Blue was for. It was like, just acknowledge you're human, be aware of these things, and then take action. But I knew there were more action items to cover other than the ones I did and wrote about in that book. So I wrote 101 Health Tips for Police Officers. It's just a plethora of information that you can do. Even something as simple as starting out your day reading an inspirational quote. Mm. Anything you can do, these little steps add up and they have a compounding effect over time. I'm proof of that after working my way out of an addiction, depression, and post-traumatic stress. Just little things can add up. And then I wrote Truths Beyond the Police Academy because I wish there were things that were told to me when I was at the academy. So I go into the fact of teamwork. That teamwork dynamic, you definitely need that. You can't be an officer in it for yourself. I worked with a few of those. I couldn't stand working with them. You got to be team-oriented. And then I wrote 101 Useful Tips for Rookie Police Officers because I worked in law enforcement over a decade, and I miss it a lot, and I really miss being a training officer. And I know that at certain departments, we have newer officers training brand-new officers. Mm. I thought, well, a 3-year very active officer knows a lot of stuff, but there's a lot of wisdom gained after being on the job for a certain amount of time. If you continuously train and work on your perspective and are there for the right reasons, doing the right thing for the public. And I felt like overall I was that officer. Of course I made stupid mistakes along the way, but there were consequences for those. By the way, double check addresses and double check warrants. Even if a deputy tells you someone has a warrant, don't go off that deputy's word. Anyway, I wrote 101 Useful Tips for Rookie Police. And it's just it's a quick read, but at the very end of the book, there's a section where you can write down what you're grateful for, which in policing, you're going to focus on the negative a lot, and you're going to encounter a lot of negative plenty of times. Why not focus on what you're grateful for too, to keep your mind straight, and then write down what you've done well, what you could do better at, and then what you plan to do to whatever, get through training or whatever your goals are, because you need to be goal oriented, not just getting through. And those have been the four books so far, but I do have one in the works. It'll be The Power in Showing Up, where it's basically lessons learned the hard way, inspiration for anyone going through this who's in a hard place, or even if you're doing just fine. There are lessons we can always learn as people to keep growing. And that's what living is, growing as a person and making a difference. So it'll be a lot about what happened to me and what I learned, but it'll be to inspire the reader. And also, if they feel alone in their struggles, they're not going to feel alone after reading the book, The Power in Showing Up, Rising in Challenge to Service to Others. So that's the books right there.
Oh my goodness. When do you have time to do this?
Oh man. I'll tell you, it's one of those where I make time in the morning. I wake up 2 hours before I have to be committed to anything. And then as of the last few years, I've been traveling, and when there's downtime in the hotel room, I'll just write and I write and I write. I find that writing is very therapeutic for me as well. So I write, and I just feel like all these things I learned from law enforcement, if I just don't do anything with them, then essentially it's a waste, in my opinion. So I just want to put it on paper and help those out there stay healthy so that they can do that much better for the public. Because if a cop is healthier, if a cop has a good mindset, then they are that much better for the public. And I want to see police do well for the public.
Yeah. And do you feel that you have mourned your loss as an officer? You're still giving to the profession.
Yeah, I reframed it mentally. I had to. I'm not working in the profession anymore. I work with the profession, but I've also had the thrill of speaking to other first responders, veterans, active military, counselors, therapists. I was recently up in Ohio, and I spoke at a mental health and recovery board advanced crisis intervention training platform. And I mean, there were people of all careers, many different careers in service to others. They were there present. So it's really making a difference, and I enjoy it a lot. I've met a lot of great people on this journey, but I do miss policing. I do. But when I find myself thinking about the past in first person, I don't think about it and say, man, those were the days. I think I'm grateful for it, and I'm looking forward to what I can utilize from the past and create a fulfillment in the future to impact others in different ways.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there are people who would have chosen the job and let the marriage fall apart.
Oh, I know. I remember a officer one time told me, I'm never going to let anyone tell me to stop doing this job. And I found that absolutely incredible that he said it, not in a good way. I was just amazed. I was shocked that he said it. But I thought to myself, why would you say that, considering the fact that when you leave here, the place moves on? You're not a big deal when it comes down to it. The organization will move on. But your family at home, that's, as one of my favorite writers, Adam Davis, says, your legacy's at home.
Yeah. Well, and you are still married, and you have gone on to have two kids, right?
Yes. And we have a third one on the way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yep. She it's going to be a girl, and I am just like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have a girl. I can't believe it, because my family, all we know is boys. So this is going to be one heck of an adventure.
Do you think either any of your kids will become, she's not born yet, but do you think either of the boys will be police?
Every now and then they'll say it, and I don't push back. I mean, it's, in my opinion, as long as you work in the right area, I'm not saying as long as you work in an area where not a lot of stuff happens. No, I don't. I mean, you're not going to learn a lot there, but it's just, I'm of the opinion if you work in a place where the cops have their hands tied behind their back, then no, don't work there, please.
Yeah. Yeah. So if someone out there is listening, and I guess what's the key message? You know, I look at you and you've got your life together. You are maybe where someone would like to be, but then maybe says to themselves, how do I ever get there? What's my first step?
Well, your first step is be you, not me, because, you know, I'm already taken by me, and then you can only be you. But I get what you're saying, and I appreciate you asking that. Whether you're struggling or not, if you seek a very powerful, impacting future, and you attach emotion to that, and I use meditation to help do that, guided meditation, then you're not a hostage of the past, because we all have baggage from the past. You can start to think about the future and not be in survival mode in the present, rather doing things to help you thrive and work towards what you want to accomplish, how you want to grow as a person, not just, quote, work till retirement and then I'll be happy. And even if that's not your perspective, keep growing as a person. That's living, not existing. I've seen it too much where we're just in survival mode. And then if you are in a bad place, take action. That's the only way it's going to work out where you get yourself out of it, is taking action. Nobody's going to do it for you. When it comes down to it, nobody's going to do it for you, but you can, you must, and you deserve to. And you know what's great? Whenever you do take action, the people you care about, the people you swore to serve, you can do that much better for them. And I know you care about that. And that's what I tell police officers whenever I travel across the country, or to anybody, because we're all human.
Also, you have the 10 code mindset.
Yeah, 10 Code Mindset YouTube channel. It's also a podcast as well. But if anyone wants to contact me, thescottmedlin.com.
Is your website.
That's okay. My website, yeah.
And it lists all four of your books. All four of your books can be bought on Amazon, mm-hmm. right? And as I said, I'm reading the first one. I find it really helpful to me personally, and I'm sure law enforcement will as well. You referenced a documentary.
Yes, I'm going to be featured in a documentary that is focused on helping the police family, but not just police families. It's first responder families. We kind of battle the same issues at times, mm-hmm. and it can be very tough on the family. So when a police officer goes through trauma, it can affect the family a lot. And the documentary is going to be, is there something going on at home? It's going to be a very powerful documentary that not only highlights the struggles that two families in particular went through, but it features Dr. Olivia Johnson with the Blue Wall Institute. She also came up with through extensive research, the Fatal 10, which is all the top 10 factors in police suicide. Mm. And she is on that documentary as well, providing stats and evidence and the expert advice about it. And then at the end of the documentary, you'll learn that there is hope, and there's ways to grow and work your way through tough times. Because it happens to everybody. Someone at some point will run through a challenge with a first responder being a member of the family, and the families will feel the effects of it somehow. And this documentary is going to focus on solutions and not just the problem.
Okay. And so people can find you on your website, The Scott Medlin, mm-hmm. LinkedIn, Instagram.
Yeah, I'm on Instagram and Twitter at The 10 Code Mindset. Yeah, I just got on Instagram. I finally got with the times. So anyway.
Yep. And do you encourage people to contact you one-on-one? Or do you?
Yes. I've helped people one-on-one before. I do have a formal coaching platform. But, you know, for quick questions, sure, contact me. I don't care. Okay. Heck, comment on a video on my YouTube channel. I'll answer it. I don't argue with people on the channel. I've made that very clear. But yeah, I mean, if you've got a question, I'll answer it.
If a department or a conference wants to have you, they can book you through your website.
Yes, there's a contact page there.
Well, you know, God works in mysterious ways. And
he does.
I feel the loss of your career, but look at what you're doing. You know, God bless you for sharing. You didn't just go crawl in a hole. You know, you chose to share what you experienced for the better of others.
Yeah, so. I had to do something. And I love what my mentor, Dr. Eric Thomas, says, don't cry to quit, cry to keep going. And that's when I heard him say that one time, I said, yeah, I got to keep going. So that's the mentality behind it. Take the pain that you've gone through, what you learned from it, and capitalize on it by impacting others in a great way so they can work their way out, or at least show them how to get through it if they find themselves facing it one day, whatever the challenge may be.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for being here.
Oh, it was an honor to be on the podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I want to thank Scott for his time today and for all he is doing in support of law enforcement. His fifth book, The Power in Showing Up, is now out and available on Amazon, as are his other four books. The documentary he mentioned, which is called Is There Something Going On at Home, is out now too and available on Amazon Prime Video. It features Scott and his wife, the struggles they went through, and how they got to where they are now. Scott mentioned they were expecting a baby girl. She has since been born, so congratulations, Scott. I will include links to Scott's social media, also his website called thescottmedlin.com, and his 10 Code Mindset YouTube channel. Those links will all be in the episode notes. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I truly appreciate it.